Five teenagers have been charged with a range of terrorism and extremism offences following the alleged stabbing of a bishop and a priest at a church in Sydney's west.
There is no absolute right to privacy.
A showdown is looming between tech entrepreneur Elon Musk and the Australian government.
We'll do what's necessary to take on this arrogant billionaire who thinks he's above the law.
I should be in Florida now. I should be in a lot of different places right now campaigning, and I'm sitting here. It's very unfair what's going on.
Disgraced Hollywood mogul Harvey Weinstein's 2020 rape conviction in New York has been overturned.
Well, a secret report into workplace culture in the Australian Border Force's Marine Unit has found that 100% of women who responded to a survey witnessed sexual and or sex-based harassment.
I personally want to apologise to those women in our workforce who have been subject to these behaviours.
A Western New South Wales man charged with murdering a young woman was on bail for several violent charges against the same victim.
To put it simply, there are serious questions for the New South Wales government to answer as to how this alleged offender was out on bail.
You are only truly safe if the perpetrator decides no longer to be abusive and violent. And I'm really sorry, but tightening of the bail laws or adjusting that justice response doesn't necessarily mean you're safe.
The rap.
Well, joining me now to wrap up what's been yet another fairly challenging week is George Brandis, a former federal attorney general under the Abbott and Turnbull governments. Hi there, George.
Good afternoon, Catherine.
And Dee Madigan, a creative director of Campaign Edge and author and a Labor Party consultant. Hi, Dee.
Hi, Catherine.
Hi. Now, it's a little bit hard to know where to start, but we will start with Elon Musk and X. Dee, the Prime Minister has called Elon Musk an arrogant billionaire as he resists to pull down this video of the alleged church stabbing in Sydney. Do you think he is, or is he a fierce defender of free speech?
Oh, he's a tosser, you know. The thing that I think annoys me the most when people describe him as a brilliant businessman, he's like, he's inherited it from daddy. And he's an absolute spoilt child, you know, who's running a company into the ground. He doesn't care. It's just all about ego.
Mm. Well, the share price, obviously, of Tesla has bottomed out this week, hasn't it?
Yeah, well, I wouldn't. You know, I always thought I'd buy a Tesla and I literally couldn't because of him.
Yeah, right. George, I know that you've been in the room over the years when you're dealing with really big tech giants on these really big issues. What has it been like to deal directly with them in government?
Well, when I was Attorney General, I found them very difficult to deal with, very uncooperative. I don't think it's about the personality of Elon Musk because they're all the same. I mean, Elon Musk is a person who's associated with right-wing politics in America, but most of Silicon Valley and the tech sector are associated with the Democratic Party. And I found them just as bad and very, very resistant to the idea that they had a responsibility to cooperate with government to ensure that social media did not host content which was damaging or threatening or promoted the sorts of behaviours about which the Australian Federal Police in particular were understandably very concerned.
Mm. Do you think it's overreach for the eSafety Commissioner to be asking for this vision to be taken down, not just in Australia but worldwide?
I don't think it's overreach. And, you know, I think the role of the eSafety Commissioner, which was an office established by the Turnbull government, is a very important one because of the pervasiveness of social media in everybody's lives today, but particularly among younger people, and how rapidly things like terrorism ideation can be spread through social media. So this is, among other things, a law enforcement issue. And nobody in this country is a stronger defender of freedom of speech than I am. But this isn't about freedom of speech. It's about the use of social media as a vehicle to promote conduct which is potentially threatening and dangerous to society and to individuals within society.
Yeah, a law enforcement issue indeed, but it's across, you know, multi jurisdictions, just national and international, which is where some of these major challenges are coming from.
Yeah.
In the midst of this debate, you have the alleged victim, the bishop, saying he wants the footage of this attack to remain online. How does that complicate matters, if at all, here? And should an alleged victim's wishes be considered in a situation such as this?
I think they should be considered, but I don't think he's correct. And I don't think he's probably looking at it from a point of view of how it encourages other people. I think what we're missing is a version of United Nations that works for the internet, because we actually do need global cooperation. Because I do think the point Elon made, which isn't untrue, is it's actually very hard to police. Mm. One of the good things with the introduction of AI, there's a lot that's wrong with it, but one of them is it should be able to identify videos much faster and remove them. But we do need all countries to buy into it. So some sort of the problem is our laws are at least 10 years behind our internet. Mm. And that's why we're in this problem. I do think that Malcolm Turnbull was probably the first Prime Minister to actually understand the internet. So we are well behind. And I do think we need broader global cooperation to get things done.
Well, we have got, you know, the Five Eyes, which is this intelligence alliance with Australia, Canada, New Zealand, the UK and the US. George, I know that you've been in some of those Five Eye meetings. Do you think there's an appetite for those member nations to take on together, collectively, these tech giants and how they disseminate information, how they potentially take information down?
This was an issue on the Five Eyes agenda when I was the minister that represented Australia in that forum. During both the Obama, it overlapped between the Obama and the Trump administrations. The problem is the United States. The other four nations in that grouping were pretty much on the same page. But in the United States, the Silicon Valley and the tech industry has enormous, enormous political power. And I don't want to be political about this, but Elon Musk really is an anomaly. He's an exceptional case. Most of Silicon Valley are hardcore supporters of the Democratic Party.
Yeah.
So, you know, ordinarily it is people on the centre-left who are a little bit more comfortable about regulation than people like me on the centre-right. But what we've found with the Americans is that the Democrats were so clientised by Silicon Valley that they were very afraid to move.
Mm.
And the centre-right were less philosophically inclined to be interventionist.
Mm. Moving on to another topic that has braced the headlines this week is domestic violence. The death of 28-year-old Molly Ticehurst has really again brought violence against women back into the national spotlight. We know that in the past few years, this issue has been elevated as a national priority. We have the national plan to end violence against women. But why do you think we're not seeing a significant shift in the numbers? Why are we still seeing women being killed every week?
I think it's important to point out that this has been the case, not in recent years, but forever. When you have societies set up whereby the sort of, you know, the legal system and the church were probably the two most powerful institutions, both of which treated women as second-class citizens by law and by Bible. You know, until the 1970s, pretty much, it was okay to beat your wife as long as you didn't beat her too hard. Women couldn't, you know, vote until, you know, early last century. They couldn't open a bank account if they were married. So all of this stems from that. But what we did see between sort of around 2000 to 2020, we did see a gradual decline, which was good. And I think was probably the result of it, people accepting that there was an issue out there and we needed to do things about it, and we had programs for men for behaviour, and also you know, teaching women what was acceptable, what wasn't, and how they could get out of these situations. But the last couple of years, or the last 18 months particularly, the rise has happened again, and I think it is probably a result of the anti-feminism movement, that the angry men, the Andrew Tates of the world, who get out there, and this goes back to social media, which rewards that kind of angry algorithm. And it says to men, it's the same thing that Trump does with American middle, you know, midtown American, saying your life has changed. It's not how it was, once was. And the fault of that is women, black people, gay rights, blah, 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 blah. And the Andrew Tates have managed to do that to young guys, saying your life isn't great. And it's because feminism and women and women's rights, and it's stoked up the anger again, and I feel like this might be where some of this is coming from.
So do you think that, you know, this rise of the counter movement still has somewhere to go?
Yeah, I think it does, and it is terrifying the way those videos just appear in young men's feeds, like, and the algorithm just does that, and it does that. And even if it's appearing in feeds of people who don't like it, it enrages them, so they respond to it. So then that increases the engagement of the video, so it's more likely to appear in other feeds. So it is this outrage that keeps perpetuating it, and it's frankly terrifying.
Yeah. George, I want to get your observations on the week that we've had. Malcolm Turnbull famously said, and I'll quote, "Disrespecting women does not always result in violence against women, but all violence against women begins with disrespecting women." The Abbott and Turnbull governments did put domestic violence into the national conversation. What are your reflections of the past week?
Well, I think it's been a terrible week, and you know, I don't pretend to know why it is that there seem to have been so many setbacks in the last couple of years, and I suspect that what Dee says about social media is part of it, but I'm sure that it's a much more complex problem than being attributable just to one cause. That said, you're right, Catherine. When I was the attorney and Michaela Cash was the minister responsible for the Minister for Women, Prime Minister Abbott, who took a great deal of interest in this issue, asked us to develop a set of policy proposals, which we did, which would give the Commonwealth Government much greater responsibility for this issue. I mean, before that, it had almost entirely been a matter for the state and territory governments. So we brought that forward with increased funding for women's shelters, for example. But, I mean, just elevated the profile of the issue. Now, in fact, because of the way in which political events happened, that package was about to be announced when Mr. Turnbull replaced Mr. Abbott as Prime Minister. So, in fact, it became, I think, the very first major suite of policy announcements during Mr. Turnbull's government, though it in fact had been prepared and developed at the instruction of Mr. Abbott when he was Prime Minister. So both of those Prime Ministers took a very deep interest in the issue. Mm. It should also be said, though, that this has been an issue of bipartisan concern and attention in Canberra ever since.
Mm. From a policy perspective, George, you know, there's been a number of calls that have been made this week, you know, calls for a roundtable, calls for bail laws to change or to at least look into the changes to bail laws from the New South Wales Premier, Rosie Batty, was suggesting a royal commission into that. What areas do you think the Commonwealth should take care of and take care of now, and where do the states need to start?
Well, you know, I mean, it's all very well to say that there should be a roundtable. There's a standing roundtable that deals with issues like this, and it's the COAG process whereby the Commonwealth and the state and territory attorneys general and other ministers in the relevant portfolios meet on a regular basis, and this is always an agenda item. So, you know, it's understandable that people would say, well, you know, we need a roundtable. We sort of got one. I think we can't, though, political leaders can't talk enough about this issue to make the community aware of how acute it is. Mm. And as with everything government does, you know, there's a funding dimension to this as well, which I think on both sides of politics, attorney generals and women's ministers and prime ministers have addressed, and it may be that that could be enlarged or reconfigured in some way. But, you know, let's not pretend that just having a round table discussion is going to it's not as if this is a new issue. It's not as if policymakers have not been worrying about and addressing this issue for years, because they have.
Dee, before we leave this topic.
I was just going to say, though, I think the problem is, though, we've always talked about it politically like a woman's issue. It was the women's minister who dealt with it, and it's not a women are the victims, but it's a men's issue. They're the ones killing the women.
Well, I think we acknowledge that, and you know, it wasn't just the women. I mean, as I said before, the policy proposal that Mr. Abbott developed was the joint responsibility of the women's minister and me as the Attorney General. So I agree with you. Of course, it's a men's issue as well as a women's issue.
Yeah, Dee, before we leave this topic, I mean, I'd like some of your thoughts on where you think the first step solutions might lie. We spoke earlier to the rally organisers for the rollout of national protests this weekend, starting tonight in Ballarat, Newcastle, and then rolling out over the weekend across the country. No more rallies for violence against women. Where do you think we need to start to make a difference here?
I think social media regulations were one of the things. I think there was a law brought in last year called the Family Law Amendment Information Sharing Act. But unfortunately, and that means judges have access to not just information from federal courts, but a whole lot of other courts as well, which can give them more information when dealing with domestic violence issues. However, it is just for the family law court. So it doesn't encompass normal bail, which is of course criminal. So I would like to see more sharing between all courts for bail so they can assess risks. But the other thing, of course, the other day was the person who bailed that guy out who was murdered his partner wasn't even a judge. There wasn't one there. It was a registrar. So that's an issue.
That's in the discussion points now as well. Moving on to mental health, Dee, I'll need to disclose here that you're a board member of the Australians for Mental Health. You would have seen front page news story today that Scott Morrison faced mental health challenges during his time as leader, suffering from anxiety that became so acute he received medication for it. What did you make of this coverage here and you know, more men in leadership positions speaking about their mental health?
I think it's really important, and I think it's good that it happens. I would have liked it. It was very Scott Morrison in it, where he said, but you know, it was the result of the callous brutality of politics and media attacks. It's like, no, journalists holding prime ministers to account is doing their job. But I think, you know, broadly the idea that, you know, people should be open about it. And of course, being a prime minister would be incredibly stressful and anxiety inducing. And I think, you know, telling people that it's okay to go to a doctor and, you know, get prescription if you need one is a really good message.
Mm. George Scott Morrison isn't the first leader, or former leader rather, to speak about his experience with mental health. He's grown this cohort of world leaders who have opened up about these issues. There was, of course, Malcolm Turnbull. He revealed his story in his memoir. New Zealand's former Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern spoke about burnout. Do you think there is the stigmas reducing around performance and mental ill health? What did you notice in your time?
This is to me.
Yes, George.
I think it's the stigma is certainly diminishing. That men in particular, men and women, but men in particular, are less embarrassed to talk about mental health issues, and that's a good thing because for all sorts of reasons, as role models for exposing these issues. I mean, men, I don't know why, but men have, you know, usually been much more shy about discussing mental and physical health than women have been. And whether it be when King Charles announced that he'd been diagnosed with cancer, or Scott Morrison talking about his mental health issues, I think men generally these days are less shy, less self-conscious about sharing health issues, particularly men in positions where they can be role models for others. So that's a good thing. I wouldn't make light, by the way, of the fact that politics is an extremely arduous profession. And across the parliament, there are colleagues who deal with mental health issues. But because of the nature of the environment, there is a very great implicit pressure to keep that to themselves.
Interesting you make that point there that, yes, of course, politics and these roles and, you know, ministerial positions leading the country is this huge impost on your life, George. What did you make about that announcement this week by two females who wanted to run as co-candidates in Higgins, the Melbourne seat there? Do you think they should be allowed to job share? Would that ease the burden?
Well, it might ease the burden, but it's just not the way our system's set up. You know, it's... If the, at the moment the law provides for single member constituencies, and unless until that law changes, I don't think we can, as it were, reverse engineer the electoral system or the constitution to suit the desire of people to maintain their lifestyle as if they weren't in politics.
If it was you know, not a constitutional change, just an electoral law change, Dee, if that was possible, which some say might be, what do you think of that, a job-sharing role in as sitting members? Is it possible? Do you see it fraught with problems or a really good way forward?
I think our system should be flexible enough to change when society does. The problem with it at the moment is... the amount of time politicians spend away from home is extraordinary. Mm. And if you're a two-parent family where someone's at home, you know, to look after the kids, that's great. If you're a single parent, it's almost not an option for you. But we know that single parents increasingly make up a larger percentage of our population. They deserve people in Parliament with lived experience of their lives, and they're not getting it. And unless we make the system flexible enough, we're going to limit ourselves to the type of people who can enter politics at all.
Mm. All right, well, on to another issue now. Anzac Day was, of course, marked and commemorated this week. George, ahead of that, we heard the Defence Minister talking about the need for the ADF to be more focused in this region here. Do you agree with that direction? And what do you think those comments mean and say about the conflicts in, say, Ukraine and Russia and how Australia helps them?
Well, it will always be the case, and this is the view across both sides of the political divide, that Australia's first and foremost focus should be on our own region. But I do think that there has been, under the Albanese government, a stepping away from a greater preparedness for engagement beyond our region. And I think that's a bad thing at a time when the world is shrinking from a strategic point of view. It's not as if the war in Ukraine is not having a direct effect on Australia, as Mr. Miles and Prime Minister Albanese and Senator Wong have acknowledged. I was disappointed, for example, that Australia declined the offer to contribute a frigate to share the burden of the patrols in the Red Sea. Australia is not a sequestered nation. I think there are a lot of Australians and some Australian politicians think we are a sequestered nation. Here in the southern hemisphere, and the world's problems are mainly elsewhere in the world, in the northern hemisphere and, you know, in the Euro-Atlantic. That's not the case. That's not the case at all. What happens on the other side of the world affects us directly, and we have to take up the burden of working with the other democracies, the United States, the United Kingdom, the European nations, to do our bit.
George Brandis, a former Federal Attorney General under the Abbott and Turnbull governments, and Dee Madigan, Creative Director of Campaign Edge and a Labor Party consultant. Thank you both for joining me.
Pleasure.
Thank you.